Exodus chapter 4. You know, last week, after we met, three different people told me that as I was speaking, they said, it was as if you were talking to yourself. And I got the impression that they were saying, it seemed like God was telling me that that was for you, for me. Well, it's not, and I wasn't talking to myself. It's all about you and not me, so just let's get that straight. But, you know, there is a question of how much should we relate to someone like Moses, who was probably the greatest figure of the Old Testament and unique in his calling from God and, you know, rose to such heights. You know, how much should we look at his life and say, you know, he's an example for all of us. And he might be an example for, you know, great world leaders. I think the answer, however, is he is, we should relate to him as much as we see in him characteristics and qualities of our own. And if we connect to him and his weaknesses, then there are lots of lessons for us to learn. So this is pretty much a legitimate way of going through the scriptures. Like, where do you feel you connect? And the only problem is if you're a narcissist and I connect with all the great people. All right, so chapter 4. But Moses protested again. What if they won't believe me or listen to me? What if they say, the Lord never appeared to you? Then the Lord asked him, what is that in your hand? A shepherd's staff, Moses replied. Throw it down on the ground, the Lord told him. So Moses threw down the staff and it turned into a snake. Moses jumped back. Then the Lord told him, reach out and grab its tail. So Moses reached out and grabbed it and it turned back into a shepherd's staff in his hand. Perform this sign, the Lord told him. Then they will believe that the Lord, the God of their ancestors, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, really has appeared to you. We pick up here where we left off last time. God is recruiting Moses for his life's mission, and Moses is trying to dodge it. The two most serious issues have already been settled. Who is Moses? And the answer is, that's irrelevant, because God is with him. And who Moses is, his true self, not the shepherd, not the grandson of Pharaoh, not the baby who was set afloat in the Nile. The true Moses is someone he will discover as he applies himself to God's will. And that's really the way it works. The closer we get to God and the better we know him and the more that we obey him, the more we become our true self. It's like, I never knew I could do that until God said, now go do that. And because I obeyed. So I'm learning these other dimensions of my life. The other issue that's been settled is, who is the Lord? And he said that his name is Yahweh. I am who I am. And that he is the one who is everywhere and always present to his people. No matter where life has taken them, no matter their circumstances, he's there. But Moses isn't finished with his objections. He's still doubtful that everything is going to go exactly as God says. And this is, in fact, the theme of the chapter. It's about resolving doubt. And so it begins with the word believe. What if the people don't believe me? And at the very end, it says, God is saying and reassuring him, and the people will believe you. So it all works out somehow between the beginning and the end. Sometimes writers will mark off a section of scripture by a theme, a phrase, a word at the beginning of the section and at the end of the section. And that word then tells us what this is all about. This is sometimes called inclusio. a literary term used of scripture, sometimes called an envelope structure, sometimes called bracketing. I like to talk about bookends. The bookends tell us where the volumes begin and where they end. And again, as I said, today it's with the word believe. God just now, in chapter 3, verse 18, told Moses, go to the people, tell them God's heard, God cares, and he's going to lead us out, and they will believe you. They will listen to your voice. But now Moses begins, but what if they don't listen to my voice? I know that the version that I'm reading from today doesn't say exactly that, and most versions don't, but that's the literal Hebrew, and I want to hang on to it for a reason. They'll believe you, God says, but what if they don't believe me? I hope that this sounds familiar to you. So what if they don't like me? What if it all turns out all wrong? I hope it sounds familiar because we are very good at doing this. I don't want to face a challenge, so I begin playing the what-if game. What if it doesn't work? What if something breaks? What if we run out of time? What if no one comes? What if no one cares? What if, what if, what if? And our brains can crank out failures all day long, potential failures. So if I'm good enough at this game, I never have to do anything. Because there's always some contingency that will result in failure. And what if that happens? What if they don't listen to my voice? Voice is a key word here. It will be repeated again. God will repeat it three times in his response to Moses in verses 8 and 9. The voice is what carries communication. The communication may be a message, it may be information, it may be prophecy, it may be a question, it may be a command, but it's the voice that carries all this. What if they don't listen to my voice? In his next objection that Moses raises, it's going to be about his own speech and about his feeling that he has no voice, nothing that anyone would want to listen to anyway. What if they don't listen? God says, well, okay, what's in your hand? And Moses says, a shepherd's staff. Something so common. I mean, anyone looking at him and seeing the sheep and seeing the staff would know what it is. So common that we wonder, why would God ask what is in your hand? Obviously, it's not because God needed to be informed. He's drawing attention to it. And the reason he's drawing attention to it is because God can do something with that staff that Moses would have never guessed. Moses did not need a new spectacular resource in order to get the people's attention. What he needed was in his hand. But we're going to have a lot of money to pull this off. We're going to need an army to help us make this happen. And God says, well, what's in your hand? Let's use that. God was able to use what he already had. I think of Jesus, and there's this huge crowd of people, and he's taught all day, and it's getting late. And he tells his disciples, we can't just send these people away. They'll faint on the way home. We need to feed them. And the disciples said, feed a crowd like this? Do you have any idea what that would take? And Jesus says, well, what do we have? And they said, well, a couple of loaves of bread and a few small fish. He says, give it to me. You have it already. You just don't know that you have it already. It's there in the staff. It's there in the meager rations. And we don't think that we have it already. And so we're not ready to move out because it's not there. We don't see the stepping stones. We just see the water, the surface of the water. And if I step out, I'm going to go down. He says, it's my shepherd's staff. God says, throw it down. And Moses throws it down, and it's a snake, and he runs from it. Throw it down. Why? What's the point? Why do I have to throw it down? I'm leaning on it right now. I don't know how much longer you're going to go on with this, so I need to rest. Why throw it down? Moses doesn't have to understand why. He just has to do what he's told. But notice, God's not like mom or dad saying, because I said so. He's taking his time with Moses. He's very, very patient with him, right? In fact, I love this about God, that he chases Moses down. And Moses keeps trying to, you know, step further away, and God keeps stepping closer. I'm not the guy. Yeah, you are. It's okay. I'm not the guy. Oh, sure you are. Like Jonah. You know, God followed him out to sea. Oh, no, Jonah. You know, you think I'm a land God? I'm going to show you something about, you know, what I'm really capable of doing. So Moses doesn't have to understand. I think that we've introduced a complication into obeying Jesus. Jesus says, if you obey my word, then you abide in me. Well, I want to abide in him. But for me, I was raised in an environment where the word obedience came to be darkness and evil and pain and suffering to me. And connected to that closely was the word responsibility. You know, all those things I was told I was so bad at, and yet was so important to, you know, being a good Christian, let alone a decent person. So Jesus says, look, you've got to obey me. And we've raised this complication. It's like, well, why are you asking me to do this? How is this going to work? I don't understand. Well, in saying I have to understand before I can act on this, I have to understand prayer before I can pray, I have to understand how this works, we limit what God does in us and through us when we force him to squeeze it through our little brains. What if we don't allow our intellect to be the gatekeeper of our experience? What if we can say, God, overwhelm me. I don't have to understand. Just let me be there in awareness. Let me experience you in as much fullness as you desire me to experience. My intellect can catch up later or just sit mystified forever. It doesn't matter as long as I'm there. I don't want my intellect to be the gatekeeper of my experience of God. I said this one time in the company of someone much deeper in God than I am, and he said, that's true. He said, you don't want your emotions to be the gatekeeper of your experience or your imagination. And I want to say, wait, my imagination can be pretty cool. I can walk on water in my imagination. But he said, well, we can imagine all kinds of wonderful things that aren't real. So we want what's real, and we don't want to limit that by our imagination. So, again, I hear Jesus with his disciples, throw it down. And I hear him say, throw your net on the right-hand side of the boat, John chapter 21. It's like, well, why do that? It's the same lake. What difference is that going to make to throw my net on the other side of the boat? Have you thought about that? Oh, the fish all like this side of the boat. Look, they're all going over there now. It doesn't work that way, to my knowledge. I'm not really a fisherman, but they throw their nets on the other side of the boat and get the biggest catch of their lives. So we don't have to understand. That's, oh, I don't care if you understand. No, that's no big deal. Just do what I say. And God says, now, so it turns into a snake. God says, now pick it up. Let me tell you something. If you're ever going to pick up a snake, don't pick it up by its tail. You know, that's about the worst thing you can do. They're all muscle, and they'll just wriggle around and bite you. Grab it behind the neck. Just, you know, but God tells him, pick it up by the tail, and it turns back into a staff. And God assured Moses that through this sign, people would believe. It's like, wow, okay, I believe now. Now, I want to, if this, with your permission, I want to stretch our interpretation of the staff a little bit. I don't know how a preacher could pass this up. And since I am a preacher as well as a teacher, I'm just going to go with it. The staff is an emblem. You know, the shepherd's staff, your rod and your staff, they comfort me. It was an emblem in a lot of early Christian art, even in catacombs. The shepherd carrying the sheep on his shoulders was one of the more frequently, it occurred, let's say, in Christian art before the cross did. So it's an emblem, but it's not a scepter in a king's hand. It's not a sword in a soldier's hand. It's not for ruling or for killing. It's for leading sheep. And so God chooses shepherds to be leaders. He finds that they make the best leaders. David, he took from following his father's sheep to become the king of Israel. Because the king who has a warrior mentality, well, you know, everything is seen as a war. But a king with a sheep's mentality, everything is about caring for the flock, finding food, finding water, going through their fur, making sure that they're all fine, or wool. Yet at the same time, before long, Moses is a ruler and he is a soldier. In fact, in Israel's first major battle after coming out of Egypt, it's as Moses holds the staff up in the air that Israel has victory over the Amalekites, those who have attacked them. So his staff becomes scepter and sword, perhaps in a way. But before that, he has to learn that there's a snake in it. And it doesn't matter if it's scepter or sword or staff, kings and soldiers, even shepherds and even parents, mom and dads, can carry authority too far because they don't know about the snake. They don't know that you can become so controlling, so harsh, so brutal, so lacking in empathy that you demand too much, you control too much, and you hurt too much. The snake has to come out of it. Okay, like I say, you know, it's a little bit fanciful, but I think it's there. Verse 6. Then the Lord said to Moses, now put your hand inside your cloak. So Moses put his hand inside his cloak. And when he took it out again, his hand was white as snow with a severe skin disease. Now put your hand back into your cloak, the Lord said. So Moses put his hand back in. And when he took it out again, it was as healthy as the rest of his body. The Lord said to Moses, if they do not believe you and are not convinced by the first miraculous sign, they will be convinced by the second sign. And if they don't believe you or listen to you, or listen to your voice, even after these two signs, then take some water from the Nile River and pour it out on the dry ground. When you do, the water from the Nile will turn to blood on the ground. God gives Moses two additional signs. You know, I think the snake is pretty good. I think that would work for me. But then he gives him these other two. The New Living Translation does not translate this, but the word hand is used twice in verse 4. And I do not believe that this is coincidental. Because in the previous chapter, God had just said that I know the king of Egypt will not let you go unless a mighty hand forces him. So I will raise my hand and strike the Egyptians, performing all kinds of miracles among them. So I can't believe now that God specifies, stretch forth your hand and take the staff again. And as he talks about, and then as he has Moses with his hand, put it into his garment, and pull it out again. I can't believe that this is just coincidental. In fact, hand is another key word, and it occurs quite a bit more often than voice does. Basically, by his own hand, God was going to deliver Israel from Pharaoh's hand using Moses' hand to do it. Further on, Moses' hand is associated with his staff. Many times it says Moses took the staff in his hand. And sometimes the one stands for the other. His hand is the staff is his hand. The repetition of hand in verse 7 is unnecessary. Once, God will say it, but, and again, the New Living Translation doesn't communicate this, but it's almost redundant how many times God says hand. I have to hand it to you. You're quite handy with that hand of yours. It's like it just goes on and on, you know. So you realize, okay, this is really important here. What am I supposed to pick up from this? Okay, so when it comes to resources, God doesn't even need the staff. Just your hand. Now just take your hand and do this with it. And he could work miracles that way. In fact, there's nothing God could not use. The Nile River was the life of Egypt. It was the source of Egypt's greatness. But it was God's also. And so his resources are plentiful. It can be as small and near to you as your own hand, or it can be as great as the Nile River. He says, I'll turn its water into blood. In verse 10, but Moses pleaded with the Lord, oh, Lord, I'm not very good with words. I never have been, and I'm not now, even though you have spoken to me. I get tongue-tied, and my words get tangled. Then the Lord asked Moses, who makes a person's mouth? Who decides whether people speak or do not speak, hear or do not hear, see or do not see? Is it not I, the Lord? Now go, I will be with you as you speak, and I will instruct you in what to say. Moses still does not give up trying to worm out of God's call. I agree with Robert Alter, a Hebrew scholar whose work I greatly admire. I agree with him regarding Moses' difficulty with speech. I've heard commentators say he was a stutterer, that he had some other kind of speech impediment. Robert Alter says it seems futile to speculate, as so many commentators have, whether or not Moses suffered from an actual speech impediment. The point is that he invokes these Hebrew idioms for impeded speech to express his feeling of incapacity for the mission, whether as hyperbole or as a physiological fact, scarcely matters. And I agree, it really doesn't matter if he had a speech impediment. I greatly doubt he did. I think that he's exaggerating. Oh, but who cannot sympathize with Moses when it comes to speeches? Think back on your high school or college dreaded oral reports. Did you ever sweat that one out before getting up? Did you ever make a fool of yourself in front of everyone? Oh, man. I was in elementary school in some stupid little play that we were putting on for another class, and I totally flubbed my line. I was some Spanish explorer coming to the new world, and I cannot remember the word magnifique or magnifico or something. And in front of the whole class, I just froze. And I felt so stupid. I looked at my teacher with this question mark, and she didn't get it. And I said, what? And she, all right, so poor Moses. Our emotions and our bodies conspire against us. It's a conspiracy, people, I'm telling you. The vicious cycle. Fear sends the body into emergency mode. Fight or flight, fight or flight. And the body responds in a way that generates more fear. Not only does it interfere with clear and rational thinking, well, what's that word, what's that word, what's that word? I'm in front of all these people, I can't remember the word, and it's my middle name. or it's my first name. And what is your name? Oh, just a minute. What are you doing with your fingers? Happy birthday to you. Trying to remember my name. What do they say when they get to dear so-and-so? Not only does it interfere with clear and rational thinking, but our mouth goes dry, our throat is constricted, our stomach knots. Again, elementary school. I wanted to try out for the glee club. Why? I don't remember. But I could sing, I could carry a tune. Not when they had me, it's like one teacher at the piano, one teacher standing over me scowling like, you. And my throat tightened and I sang falsetto, sounded like my baby sister, and was not accepted into the glee club. That's probably worked in my favor. I became really good at tetherball. All right, so Moses says, speech is not really my gift. I talk, no one listens to me. And who doesn't feel that way? But that kind of thinking can be dangerous. A person's entire life can be determined by what they don't have. I don't have the talent. I don't have the time. I don't have the energy. I don't have the resources. I don't have the patience. I don't have the stomach for it. I don't have. The most fun and inspiring people to work with are those who say, well, I've never done it before, but I'm willing to give it a try. Oh, I love working with people like that. It's just that positive, optimistic, you know, well, let's just go and try it. Who knows? We'll never know until we try. And I believe that that's the kind of person that God finds pleasure in. Well, God, I've never done this before, but I'll give it a try. Street witnessing. And then I'd come back, okay, I found out. The eyes of the Lord search the whole earth in order to strengthen those whose hearts are fully committed to him. That fully committed heart says, I've never done it before, but I'm willing to try. And he's searching for that. And I think some employers also are in their screening process. We cannot use our deficiencies to weasel our way out of God's will for our lives. He asks Moses, who makes a person's mouth? Oh, my mouth is heavy, my tongue gets thick, I can't talk. Well, who made your mouth? I'm telling you to do something. You think I'm not going to take care of the details? You're talking to the manufacturer of the technology. So, he's the one who gives the gift. Well, I don't have that gift. Well, you will. He's the one who gives the talent, the aptitude, who provides us with the time and energy of our lives. Now go. I will be with you. I think the go here is emphatic. The exclamation mark belongs there. Now go. I will be with you. Only here he doesn't simply say, I will be with you. He says, I will be with your mouth. I will be with that messed up mouth of yours. Yeah, that's pretty cool. So just go, Moses. I will make it work. Verse 13. Hey, we're almost through. This is going to be a record. But Moses again pleaded, Lord, please send anyone you want to send, just not me. Then the Lord became angry with Moses. All right, he said. What about your brother Aaron, the Levite? Oh, you have to bring my brother up. Why can't you be more like your brother? I know he speaks well. And look, he is on his way to meet you now. He will be delighted to see you. Talk to him and put the words in his mouth. I will be with both of you as you speak. Literally, I will be with both of your mouths. It's only, he says, I will be with your mouth and I will be with Aaron's mouth as you speak. And I will instruct you both in what to do. Aaron will be your spokesman to the people. He will be your mouthpiece, and you will stand in the place of God for him, telling him what to say. And take your shepherd's staff with you and use it to perform the miraculous signs I have shown you. At last, Moses has run out of disqualifications. And in a way, he's returned to that first question when he asked, well, who am I? Only here, he's saying it like this. It's more like, I'm not that person. Send whoever you want, but send the right guy, and I'm not the right guy. Then Yahweh's anger burned towards Moses. Okay, he's standing beside a burning bush, right? So I imagine the fire in the bush flaring up. There's an open quad area in this place where I like to hang out when I have time. And I meet with a friend there almost every Friday. And they have this outdoor gas fire. And when it's a cold morning and you can turn it on, it's really nice. But there's something wrong with this thing, and they really need to repair it. Because every once in a while, it just kind of makes a noise, but there's actually no flame. And then all of a sudden, it goes, whoomp. And I've seen people jump, which is kind of fun. Actually, I should put a camera there. But this is what I see. The bush goes, whoomp. You know, the anger of Yahweh burns. Whoomp. When we read that God's anger burned, all this tells us is what God wants us to see. We have no idea what God actually experiences. I can tell you this, he never loses his temper. And if he gets angry at someone's recalcitrance, disobedience, well, he would just have to be angry all the time, wouldn't he? Would he ever not be angry? Would his anger never not be burning? So it doesn't really tell us much about God. And God does not live in a state of anger. I don't believe God gets angry. You say, well, you're contradicting Scripture. No, I'm not. I'm saying that what God, well, maybe I am. I'm saying that what God tells us about himself is what he wants us to know about himself. And it communicates what he wants to communicate to us. But you cannot define whatever God feels by our words, our human words. You have to let God reshape our words. And he fills them with a different meaning than what they have for us. If I get angry at another motorist, what I experience is nothing like anything that exists in God. Does that make sense to you? Please nod. If you shake your head, I'm going to give up. I'm going to give up anyway. Thank you. God says, okay, you won't be the spokesperson. You're going anyway. You won't be the front man. We'll let Aaron take care of that. And God says, Aaron will be as if he were your prophet, and you will be as if you were God telling your prophet what to say. God says, I'll tell you. So it does come from God. He's not saying you're going to be like God to Aaron. Do you understand that? I don't know if I really need to explain that. He's saying it's as if this is how it works. This is the flow of communication, basically. And then Aaron will tell the people. I will be with your mouth and with Aaron's mouth. And the conversation ends here with a final word of instruction. Now, remember that from the very start, when the voice first spoke to him, stop, Moses, take off your sandals, you're on holy ground. That Moses covered his face because he was afraid. He was afraid to look at God. And from the very beginning, Moses is terrified. This type of experience, like the dreaded oral report, throws the body into the fight or flight syndrome. His nervous system would be geared up at this point to race down the mountainside. I don't care if it's dangerous. I'm not even looking back. Is he close? Is he close? Is he gaining on me? I'm out of here. This is the mobilization of the body's organs, especially the heart and the lungs, and the distribution of blood and oxygen in the body for intense action. And we stay in that sympathetic state until we're well out of danger and our body is able to return to its normal state or its homeostasis, its parasympathetic mode. So he is geared up to run away, but no one says no to God. So he stays there and he tries to talk his way out of what God is throwing at him, but he's not able to do so. Maybe that's what he means when he says, I've never been very good with words, not even now. See, you're not listening to me. Are you listening to me? Am I persuading you of anything? No. Just keep coming at me. And I'm trying to tell you, no, you're wrong. You got the wrong address, wrong phone number. He can't change God's mind about using him for this work. And I find this fascinating, that Moses can't change God's mind. Well, he's just a man, and God is God. God makes up his mind. But you know, later on, he does change God's mind. He argues with something God intends to do. This is in chapter 42. He said, or 32. Pardon me. So the Lord changed his mind about the terrible disaster he had threatened to bring on his people. This is after the golden calf incident. He did change God's mind. He can't change God's mind about this. You know, I think that God allows some contingency. I have a plan, and I'm going to carry it through. I have another plan, and we can do it this way, or we can do it that way. And I'm willing to let you change my mind. So pray. It's because God allows contingencies that prayer works. Sometimes in that way. God's challenge here is to help Moses calm down, to trust him enough to calm his nervous system down so he can hear what God's saying and be open to receive it. And right now, Moses is all defensive. It's the natural state of the sympathetic mode of the autonomic nervous system. So God begins trying to calm him down by answering his objections. Okay, what has you so upset, Moses? What has you saying no? What has you afraid, thinking you can't do this? Oh, it's that? Well, that's irrelevant. I'll be with you. Who am I? I'm Yahweh. I'm everywhere present to you at all times. You don't think the people will believe you? Okay, I'm going to give you some signs to show them. They'll believe you. See how God is working with them? I want you to just relax. I've got it all worked out. You're going to be fine. I have all power. Don't worry about this. But Moses has just grown more desperate. He sees the walls closing in more and more. He sees God coming at him more and more and not relenting. Now, two emotions conclude this conversation. Two emotions and another factor. The first emotion is God's anger. And maybe what God is doing here is just clearing his throat as though to say, all right, Moses, I've had enough. You're afraid to go to Egypt. I'm going to make you more afraid of not going to Egypt. Now you have Yahweh angry at you. You see how that may work? It's like, okay, maybe I can't calm you down. I'll send a nervous Barney Fife into Egypt, and you'll be their rescuer. Was that his last name, Barney? Yeah, I think so. Okay, thank you. I'm sorry. It's the only image that came to mind. I'm nervous. What can I say? My brain's not working. So that's the one emotion. On the one hand, there's this anger. And then there's this other factor. Aaron, his brother, is coming. And here's the other emotion. Aaron will be delighted to see him. Ah, Moses, you know, I've been searching the desert for you. Or I heard you were in Midian. Here I am. I've come to meet up with you. Stephen Porges is a neuroscientist who's looked very closely for years at this autonomic system in our brainstem that turns on or off this vigilant mode, this fight or flight mode. And he talks about the social engagement system. And it's interesting because it's the same cranial nerve, the vagus nerve, that turns on our sympathetic mode, fight or flight, and turns on our parasympathetic mode at rest and normalcy. It just depends on which nucleus in the medulla the vagus goes from. And on the one hand, the vagus nerve descends to our heart and our lungs, and it ascends in a circuitous way to the somatic sensory cortex of the brain and the motor cortex. So what we feel in our viscera, we can, you know, can affect our brain. And then our brain also affects the viscera. Sensory messages go up, motor messages go down. We'll do this. Constrict, you know, tighten up. Pool blood so that it's ready to go to the muscles as needed. Dilate the blood vessels around the stomach. You don't want to be digesting food right now. Maybe you'll suffer indigestion. Maybe you'll have ulcers if you have to do this for too long. But just for this moment of fight or flight, we need to conserve because the blood will be needed. Dilate the pupils so that you see more. There's all kinds of things that go on in our bodies, people. We are fearfully and wonderfully made. And at the heart of it is the vagus nerve and what Stephen Porges calls the social engagement system. And he talks about how our brains, I'll say designed, he would say evolved, to be in relationship with other people and in positive social engagement to calm them down. And part of this, you can hear in the intonation of a mother's voice when she's telling her child, there, sweetheart, it's okay, you'll be all right. That intonation, it's called prosody, P-R-O-S-O-D-Y. I don't even know how it's pronounced because I'm stupid, but I'm a reader, not a listener. And it has to do with a melodic quality of the mother's voice. There, it's all right. And we'll talk to friends that way, maybe not just like that, but, oh, really, I'm so sorry to hear that. And what does this do? This does not just communicate to a person's mind, oh, that's so thoughtful. It's changing their body. It's changing what's happening in the chemistry and functions of their body. And they're feeling it inside. They're feeling comforted by this other person. So Porges says, the emotional engagement system emerges from a heart-face connection that coordinates the heart with the muscles of the face and head. Aww. See the expression, the tilt of the head, the with the facial nerve, working with the vagus nerve, it brings expression to our face. At the same time, it's regulating our heart rate. Our heart is really speaking through our face. And our face is affecting the heart at the same time. He says that strong and supportive bonds soothe the other person and that we co-regulate each other's emotions. Control yourself. Don't lose your temper. Regulate your emotions. Well, sometimes it's the friend or spouse that helps us to regulate the emotions. Their calmness soothes us. Aaron's delight is going to be infectious for Moses. He is going to feel Aaron's delight. And he is going to feel more positive about this mission. He's going to be thinking more clearly. He'll be in a better state of mind and body when he reconnects with his brother And he's able to calm down and now face the challenge God has put to him. God says, Moses, here's how it is. And instead of saying, okay, Lord, yes, sir, he begins a conversation and tries to weasel out. And God follows him through the conversation, answering his objections. In other words, God is willing to have a conversation with him about this. Okay, Moses, you're upset. You don't understand. Let's just talk about it. Okay. Conversation is a process that God uses to work his will into our lives. If God told you today, I want you to sell everything, get a loincloth, and move to Papua New Guinea, and work with headhunters up in the mountains. Charles would be the only one who'd be up for it. The rest of us, we'd have to have a conversation with God. Right? Well, Lord, I don't like bugs. Oh. I'm going to provide you with plenty of insect repellent. God, right? This is how he works. He doesn't just force it on us. He wants cooperation. He wants our participation. He wants our willingness. He gave us free choice, and he gave it to us so he could know that we love him by choosing him. And he's willing to work with that. He knows it doesn't all just come to us so easily. I know someone that when this person reads the Bible, they get upset. Like it's all nonsense, or it has no meaning, it makes no sense. It's like every line of the Bible confuses this person. And so this person doesn't ever read the Bible. Of course, it really helps if you read the whole thing, and if you have a problem with it, read it again. But listen, I get upset by things I read in the Bible. I go, did this really happen? Or did God really mean this? Did he really say this? And I don't say the Bible's nonsense. I say, I'm missing something. And I begin a conversation. And God will eventually work into me his will or his message. Now, I may say, you know, I still don't understand that passage, but I'm at peace with it. God has brought me to that point. I can live with it. And it's not going to upset my faith in him. Right? But you have to stay with the conversation. So that's my message to you today. Stay with the conversation to hear God out. Don't just get frustrated about something and turn away. Don't just say, well, this will never make sense to me, or I'll always find this offensive. Just stay with your conversation with God. Stay with whatever you believe he's telling you about yourself or what he wants you to do. Stay with it. Let patience have its perfect work in you so that you may be made complete, entire, and lacking nothing. All right, James 1:4. Would you stand, please? Thanks to the gift of elaboration, we didn't finish any earlier today. I apologize. Not being able to speak is not my problem. Talking too much, that's another thing. May the Lord bless us, keep away all evil, and lead us into eternal life. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.